Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the increasingly deadly and infectious strain of COVID, the Delta variant, impacting states with low vaccination rates, and the role of Republican politicians and Fox News in encouraging Americans not to vaccinate. With Republicans in Tennessee firing their top COVID official, Dr. Michelle Fiskus, for trying to vaccinate teenagers against this new deadly strain, Jonathan Metzl, professor of sociology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt University and director of its Center for Medicine, Health and Society, joins us. We'll discuss how conspiracy theories have infected Republican politics and how Republicans apparently feel you don't have a right to vote, but you do have a right to infect. The author of Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland, will discuss how back in December, Kaiser Health News and the Associated Press found that at least 181 state and local public health leaders in 38 states had resigned, retired, or had been fired since April the 1st of 2020. And now the latest victim, Dr. Fiskus, notes, quote, "It's just a huge symptom of just how toxic the whole political landscape has become. This virus is apolitical. It doesn't care who you are or where you live or which president you preferred." Then with the House Democratic Whip James Clyburn urging Senate Democrats to pass the For the People Act via a carve-out of the filibuster for voting rights, we will speak with Keisha Gaskins-Nathan, a lawyer, voting rights advocate, and director of the Democratic Practice Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. She joins us to discuss how voting rights and election reform legislation has become the top priority for Democrats in the face of new voter suppression in Republican-led states based on Trump's lies about the stolen 2020 presidential election, which Biden referred to yesterday as election subversion. Then finally, we'll look into the $3.5 trillion infrastructure package the Democrats plan to pass via budget reconciliation and assess whether the Republican senators who agreed to an earlier bipartisan infrastructure package might be peeled off under pressure from Republican activists already running TV spots against Republican senators who joined with Democrats. Robert Johnson, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, who was previously the chief economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee, joins us. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Jonathan Metzl, who's a professor of sociology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt University and the director of its Center for Medicine, Health and Society. He's the author of several books and a prominent expert on gun violence and mental illness. And his latest book is Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Metzl.
Thanks so much. Good to be back.
So it seems like it's not just dying of whiteness that's killing the homeland, particularly the red states. You're in Tennessee. But people are dying of ignorance, willful ignorance, and ignorance from politicians. The states with the lowest number of COVID-19 vaccination rates have three times higher infections in this last week than other states where people are fully vaccinated. This is, of course, in particular, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Florida, Missouri, Nevada. I don't know what the situation is in Tennessee, but Tennessee has just fired its top vaccine official for trying to get teenagers vaccinated. How did that happen?
Well, you call it willful ignorance, but I would call this volitional in a way. I mean, the information is out there about the COVID implications. It's certainly out there about the effects of the Delta variant, which is more lethal, more infectious, more dangerous overall. So it's not like that information's not out there. I mean, I think at this point, a number of people, not everyone, but a number of people are making a conscious decision to get infected with a more lethal strain of the coronavirus. And so, that's a choice that they're making. And they're making that for political reasons. They're making that for ideological reasons. And so the question will be in 2 weeks from now or 3 weeks from now, as unfortunately and predictably the death rates really start to go up, do people feel like that was a choice that was worth it, in a way? Now, we could talk a lot about the ideology that's behind it, and certainly some of it is about disinformation. What we see in Tennessee is people who are actually trying to get the word out and trying to inform people are, in particular arenas, in particular red states, being fired from their jobs. That's what happened in Tennessee. So there is an information issue out there, but it's also like at this point in the game, there's no mystery what the COVID virus does to the human body. We know that, and it's just getting worse. And so, really, people are making this choice.
Well, but patients always listen to doctors and authority figures. At least that's how it's always been. So surely you can't let these politicians and the media, particularly people like Tucker Carlson and Fox News and those that spread disinformation, dangerous disinformation. I mean, some of these people may be willfully doing it and willfully ignorant and volitional, but I suspect a lot of them are being influenced.
Well, certainly they're being, I mean, nobody had heard of COVID-19 2 years ago. Nobody'd heard of the vaccine a year ago. And so these were neutral topics for the most part that are shaped by different ideologies, but they tap onto existing beliefs. I mean, when I did my research about the Affordable Care Act, I saw people basically saying, "I know I could be helped by the Affordable Care Act, but it's more important to me that I don't sign up for the evil government, even if it's trying to help me by giving me health insurance and things like that." Now, I could say on one hand they're being influenced, and they certainly are. And I think there's a culpability right now. There's a real culpability for people who are telling people not to get vaccinated. But ultimately, what people are saying is they want individual choice, and they're ultimately, I mean, in a way, I'm tired of arguing with people. It's kind of like they're making their individual choice, and so I guess it's a two-pronged thing. I certainly think that there should be better, more information. And to be honest, there's a ton of hypocrisy, right? All these people at Fox News, you can bet, are getting themselves vaccinated. So there's a lot of performativity here, but ultimately people are making a choice with the information that they have.
Well, Trump and Melania got vaccinated in secret, and so did Governor DeSantis down in Florida. So you're right about the hypocrisy, Jonathan Metzl. But it feels like we're in an Orwellian age here, particularly when it comes to red states and Republicans, because according to Republican politicians, you don't have a right to vote, but you have a right to infect.
Well, again, that's why I said that you can make the choice for yourself, but that's not how COVID works, right? In other words, people can make individual choices. I mean, I guess it's akin to secondhand smoke. You can smoke or not, but when your secondhand smoke infects everybody around you, then all of a sudden it's not just about you anymore. And that's kind of how COVID works. People can decide not to get vaccinated, but the implications of that are spreading the virus to tons of other people. And so certainly there's a chain effect. I'll say empathically, the frustration here is that, I mean, we've been at this for like a year and a half. People are exhausted. It's hard. It's what we're doing is hard. It's almost hard to get your mind around. You think about the beginning of the pandemic, people thought, man, if this thing lasts 3 weeks, that would be something. And now we're a year and a half into it, and there's another wave coming. But on the other hand, the United States is in the best shape, right? I mean, we have access to the vaccine. Hardly any place else in the world has the kind of access we do. So I don't know. I mean, again, I study this and I'm feeling a lot of despair myself. And when people are being fired who are actually the people gathering the data and producing a kind of, it's not just willful ignorance, it's like strategic ignorance. It's almost hard to know what to do. I mean, I want people to be safe, but I'm feeling distraught about that myself at the moment.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Metzl, who's professor of sociology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt University and the director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. He's the author of several books and a prominent expert on gun violence and mental illness. And his latest book is Dying of Whiteness: How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. And what you just said, Jonathan, is echoed by Dr. Michelle Fiskus, who just got fired by the Republican legislature in Tennessee for trying to get teenagers immunized. She said, "The virus is apolitical. It doesn't care who you are or where you live or which president you preferred." And then she went on to say, "It's just been a very difficult thing for us to overcome." And you just echoed those thoughts too. So it's pretty dispiriting, you know, and it also has a political effect. I mean, I think the Biden administration thought that they were really going to be heading into an era where Americans will be coming out into the malls and into the movie theaters and celebrating, and everybody would be feeling good. But this new strain, this Delta strain, is with us. And you said you're tired of trying to argue with these people, but don't they recognize how the death rate, which was so high at the beginning of the year, is now dropped dramatically? Is the cause and effect is obvious. The reason people aren't dying in droves now as they were 6 months ago is because of the vaccination, isn't it? I mean, it's so clear. Have you tried that argument?
Well, again, you know, the I mean, yeah, I'm not trying this. I'm trying this argument with like people who, you know, I have a lot of friends who are Trump supporters who I'm trying these arguments on. And then I'm just kind of, I mean, ultimately, the only argument that I've found that works is you are an autonomous individual. You have access to the same information I do. You have the right to make a choice. I hope you make the right choice. Like, to me, that's, you know, that I mean, I'm waving the white flag in terms of trying to say I know something better than somebody else at this point. We all have access to this information, and I guess the only thing I tell people is I hope you make the right choice for your sake because I care about you. I mean, that's really my strategy at this point. But I have to, I guess deep down, I feel like I have to respect them to make the choice. Now, that's on an individual level, that's my personal strategy. On a political level, I've studied guns for a long time. I know that there's much more gun death than we know in this country. The reason we don't know, even though we should, is because the NRA basically single-handedly destroyed the research infrastructure about studying gun safety for 3 or 4 decades. So nobody knows how to make people safe from guns. And so they're doing the same thing with COVID, not the NRA, but the GOP. They're basically destroying not just they're destroying people's right to like make an informed decision, basically, by destroying data gathering. That's what's happening in Tennessee. When you fire people who are public health experts, you know, you're firing expertise, right? And you're replacing that with ideology. And so where I do think is a moral and criminal failure, is to destroy the mechanisms through which we even get information about the spread of COVID in the first place, or the effect of the vaccines. But that's what seems to be happening in a lot of places. And for me, that's different from my individual life. That's a place where I personally feel like there's a tremendous amount of culpability, and it's going to get more urgent as more people die. I mean, you know, we're going to see a lot of people die here.
Well, but as an expert on the subject, Jonathan Metzl, you may have waved a white flag with your friends, but that doesn't stop you from going after these politicians. I mean, the local newspaper there in Nashville, the Tennessean, is reporting that Dr. Fiskus had just got fired for trying to get teenagers vaccinated. It's not just that the department is pulling back on its vaccination outreach efforts to children, but it's doing it for all diseases, not just coronavirus. So this is like the Republican legislature in Tennessee has been captured by the anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's urgent and it's catastrophic and it's just friggin' medieval, honestly, is all I can say. You know, I mean, we're inviting back not just coronavirus, which you can see that's what we're doing. We're inviting back coronavirus now, but we're also inviting back every other disease that we had found effective treatments for, under the auspice of ideology, and this false racialized idea of kind of survival of the fittest and all these other kind of ideologies. And so again, like I think there needs to be accountability for these political decisions, for these politicians, for media disinformation, all of these, there's going to be a reckoning for these decisions again, as deaths really start to accelerate among people pretty soon here, unfortunately. But individually, again, it's different from having conversations. You know, I think ultimately the conversations part is difficult again because you're having them in the context of all these other bigger structures.
Well, this, of course, has been going on for some time, and it's right across the country, this problem, because there was a review published in December by the Kaiser Health News and the Associated Press that found that 181 state and local public health leaders in 38 states have resigned, retired, or been fired since April the 1st of 2020. So, you know, that's kind of, when you mentioned it's medieval, it's almost like witch burning, isn't it?
Well, and again, the sad part is, you know, Twitter doesn't speak for most people. Politics right now doesn't speak for most people. You know, but everybody's caught in the crossfire, right? I mean, there are a lot of people who don't support these politics, but they're going to catch COVID regardless because they can't find a vaccine in a place like Tennessee. So it's just it's dispiriting. Again, people are making their minds and they're making the wrong choice.
Right. Well, so the only way for these people to be educated is when they and others around them get infected and start dying. Is that what it comes down to, Jonathan?
Well, I mean, again, I think it's important to note that they have an ideology. I mean, people have an ideology. Some people are profoundly health libertarian. They feel like they have the right to make every decision about their individual care. So that's one ideology. We can debate that. Other people are foot soldiers in a much, you know, the narrative I write about in my book, where, in a way, control for the GOP depends on the kind of sacrifices that they're making right now. So there's a very racial component to kind of dying in the name of owning the libs or defeating the Democrats or, you know, defeating social justice. But, you know, there are different ideologies at play. It's important that we don't, you know, that we recognize what all of those are. But I guess that's important just because it's not just like getting sick is going to change people's mind. I mean, sometimes people get sick and it reinforces their ideology even more. You know, all I can say is it's a hard time to be thinking about communal public health in that environment. But unfortunately, you know, places that are doing it, like much of the rest of the world or, you know, the East Coast United States, they're just having much, much better outcomes. Whereas in Tennessee, we're firing the experts.
And there are a couple of sentient politicians out in Tennessee, Jim Cooper and the, I can't think of his name now, the
John
guy
Ray
that,
Clements.
yeah, the guy that brought a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken to here
Oh
in Europe.
yeah. There are a lot of people. Yeah, there. I mean, there are
What's
people
his
fighting
name
back,
again?
of course. I can't. I don't. I can't remember offhand, but there are people fighting back.
Right.
There are people fighting back. I mean, John Ray Clements is another person that people should follow. He's phenomenal. So,
Then you've got Marsha Blackburn, the senator, and other. She's totally reactionary, right?
yeah. No. And again, I think again, you know, she represents an ideology. It's just, you know, we've assumed we've been on a progress narrative. And again, you know, she speaks for a lot of people, a lot of people who feel like they're making the right decision. So again, I reject the term, you know, ignorance or things like that, because I think, you know, people are making decisions. They're not the decisions I would make. You know, we're going to pay a very heavy price for these decisions. But You know, it's just it's a complicated time because you would think in a country like communal public health would be the one thing we could agree on, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
And they certainly did agree back when the polio vaccine came out. People lined up for that. So it's a very different world that we're in today, unfortunately. And I thank you for joining us, Jonathan Metzl.
Thanks, and hopefully next time we talk, we'll have some more cheerful news. But I would just say, firing the experts in Tennessee is really has really really set a pall for many of us. It's a worrisome beacon of what might be down the pike.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Metzl, who's a professor of sociology and psychiatry at Vanderbilt University and the director of its Center for Medicine, Health and Society. He's the author of several books and a prominent expert on gun violence and mental illness. And his latest book is Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into House Democratic Whip James Clyburn's efforts to urge Senate Democrats to pass the For the People Act via a carve-out of the filibuster for voting rights. I don't need no doctor, 'cause I know what's in me. I don't need no doctor, no, no, 'cause I know what's in me. Yeah. Been too long away from a man. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Keisha Gaskins-Nathan, a lawyer, voting rights advocate, and director of the Democratic Practice Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. She has spent much of her career advocating for the rights of underserved populations, especially with regard to voting rights and democratic reform. And from 2007 to 2011, she was the executive director of the League of Women Voters Minnesota, which succeeded in registering over 10,000 new voters during her tenure. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keisha Gaskins-Nathan.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it seems like the House of Representatives, and in particular the House Majority Whip James Clyburn, are pressuring the Senate Democrats to deal with what has to be done, which is to pass the For the People Act. President Biden, speaking yesterday at the birthplace of American democracy in Philadelphia, made a very impassioned and powerful speech. He didn't talk about the filibuster, but it was pretty clear what his parting words were, which is to get it done. Let's get it done. It can be done. Let's get it done. So are you encouraged in any way? Do you think that something's going on there in conversations between Clyburn and Senator Manchin?
I think clearly there is something going on. It was really good to see the president take a stand. I think, he ran on a platform, and really seeing him stand up and speak very clearly and definitively around the rights of voters, the rights of people, and to really get this work done, to say that this is the legislation to do that, was incredibly important.
And it seems like the delegation of Democrats from the Texas legislature, who for a second time had to get out of town to deny quorum so that the Republicans could not push through in this time around an even more draconian bill with all kinds. I mean, they compromised, I guess, on the souls to the polls part, which was outrageous. But then they added a whole bunch of other things, including empowering poll watchers and giving poll watchers more power over the poll workers. And in fact, poll workers would be fined and imprisoned for in any way resisting the activities of poll watchers. And as far as I know from the country's history, particularly going back to Jim Crow, poll watchers basically just intimidate, don't they? And the idea that you can show up at polls with guns intimidating people, I just cannot believe that that is what we've sunk to. But that's apparently what's in the Republican bill in Texas.
Right. I think what that bill reflects is, I think, a certain strategy with using poll workers. There certainly are poll watchers, that are well-trained, that simply record information, that watch and are poll watchers. But certainly we have seen strategies from Jim Crow and forward where poll watchers are used to intimidate voters. Poll watchers are used to undermine ballot access. And in this case, in the Texas bill, you know, I'm a poll worker here in New York City. And the very idea that a poll worker could be imprisoned for ensuring access to the ballot under the law is shocking. So in this case, it really represents why the For the People Act matters so much, to have a piece of federal legislation that sets a floor, that sets a standard nationally for what has to be done for access to the ballot is incredibly important.
So let's talk about what's at the heart of this possibility that there can be a break in this deadlock, because the Republicans, of course, have the advantage of the filibuster, and they've been using that, and it's a completely painless operation. It's nothing like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, where you have to hold the floor, like Jimmy Stewart did. You can just phone it in. And we've had resistance from Senators Manchin and Sinema. Senator Sinema wrote a piece recently in the Washington Post justifying the filibuster, which was absolutely, completely wrong in almost every respect. So one hopes that she's getting educated on the history. It's not in the Constitution in any way, the filibuster. It's just a simple Senate rule. And what Clyburn and others are asking for is just what's called a carve-out, right? Which is what you have for judicial nominees. So
absolutely. It is exactly what we have for judicial nominations. And it's a similar carve-out to be able to say, look, when we're dealing with constitutional issues, we don't want to be tied up in this way. We want to be able to legislate, as Congress should be able to do, to get the work of the people done. It's good that Clyburn and Manchin are negotiating. I think you raised something really important, which is, of course, you know, Sinema has her own constituents and her own mind. That negotiating between Clyburn and Manchin will move a needle if they can come to agreement. But, you know, there's no indication that Manchin controls Sinema. And so there will be more, like, this is part of a process. It's going to require the administration. It's going to require, I think, dedication, like Clyburn, like others in the Democratic Party that have shown a real dedication to these questions and really said, you know, these constitutional rights need to be upheld.
And again, I'm speaking with Keisha Gaskins-Nathan, a lawyer, voting rights advocate, and director of the Democratic Practice Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. She spent much of her career advocating for the rights of underserved populations, especially with regard to voting rights and democratic reform. And from 2007 to 2011, she was executive director of the League of Women Voters Minnesota, which succeeded in registering over 10,000 new voters during her tenure. So I'm curious, though, Keisha, as to why it is that neither Manchin nor Sinema have the simple political fact of self-protection and survival, which seems to be pretty foremost in most politicians' minds. They want to get reelected. Mm-hmm. And in this case, they want to be in the majority. There's no fun being in the minority, as Mitch McConnell has made clear. He didn't even want to, even when he lost, he didn't want to give up being the majority leader. So if in the next election, we've had so much gerrymandering that many analysts predict that the Republicans will pick up the House before one vote is taken, and in the Senate, it's hanging by a thread, and with all the voter suppression that's been passed down in Georgia, on the surface, it would seem that Raphael Warnock would not be reelected, and that would be enough to put Sinema and Manchin in the minority, along with Schumer and company. So that's the part I don't understand. Don't they want to be in the majority?
I think they do. And I think the one thing that we have to remember is while there is the national dynamic that you've identified, and I wouldn't count Georgia out yet, but the national dynamic that you've identified, they still have to deal with the voters in West Virginia. They still have to deal with the voters in Arizona. And I think they have a litmus test that might be different than what we think about in terms of the national dynamic and trying to walk, I think, a very particular political line. At the end of the day, however, these political machinations are broadly not serving the American people. They're not able to legislate. They're not able to move key issues forward. And, you know, importantly, this For the People Act really does center around core protections of democratic principles and ballot access.
But voters in West Virginia and in Arizona will soon be getting child credit checks. They surely want infrastructure. The one state that desperately needs infrastructure is West Virginia, particularly broadband.
Certainly.
So I imagine Biden's out there ready to shovel the pork, isn't he?
Well, I think that, I mean, that's a negotiation, isn't it? That as I said, I think this is going to be a political negotiation, that we're going to see conversations like Clyburn's, you know, longstanding colleagues having discussions, necessitating, you know, intervention and support from the administration. You know, this is not, it's not as simple and straightforward, I think, as many of us would like to think, but it's absolutely doable and essential.
Well, at one point, Senator Manchin did say that he was in favor of making the filibuster a standing filibuster, which, again, would go back to our sort of idea of the filibuster from the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. So mm-hmm. would that be another alternative to the carve-out? The carve-out seems to be the simplest and easiest, doesn't it?
This carve-out is really straightforward and is really centered around, I think, really key constitutional principles. And we should be protecting constitutional principles and enabling the Senate rules to facilitate that as effectively as possible. And it's not able to do that now. So the carve-out makes the most sense. I think returning to a standing filibuster may make it more difficult to hold the filibuster. But if an individual senator really wanted to hold the floor, they still could. And I think the idea here is to say, is there a category of legislation that is so important to governance? Is there a category of legislation that's so important to protecting the rights of American people that we need to carve out? And that decision was made, yes, in the case of judicial nominations. And in terms of constitutional rights, it should be made here.
So I mentioned the delegation of Democrats from Texas, from the legislature, who snuck out of town for a second time, and they're in Washington. I believe last time around they met with Joe Manchin. They first met with his staff and then later with him. And I think they thought that they were making an impression. The fact that they had to resort to avoid a quorum, surely that resonates. And I mean, Manchin somehow thinks that the filibuster is a bipartisan tool and a tool of compromise. When the Texas delegation shows up, they are poster children for the fact that there's no compromise. Compromise is impossible. I mean, they had hearings, and Beto O'Rourke spoke at 4 a.m, but the Republicans weren't listening. You know, these are the realities. I'm not entirely clear about what it is. I mean, I mentioned the op-ed that Senator Sinema wrote, which most legal scholars found pretty bizarre. But I don't quite know what it is about Manchin's justification for the filibuster. Do you have an idea for it or an explanation?
You know, I think we have to look to Manchin's own words about what he believes the importance of the filibuster to be in terms of balance, in terms of equity, in terms of a bipartisan tool. I think what you point to is the idea that bipartisan tools only work where legislators hold principles of governance and statesmanship above partisanship. And it's not clear that that's what's happening here. So I think it is difficult to understand within the context and that, you know, Manchin is being standing on a set of principles that aren't necessarily playing out in real life as we look at how some of the actors are operating in this space. But at the end of the day, you know, this is the constitutional carve-out is really about protecting the rights of citizens on issues that, as I said, are important and essential to governance and to protect access to the polls and other fundamental rights. So in that case, it feels like the way to sort of avoid some of the challenges presented by political gamesmanship is to permit, in certain select cases, the ability to be able to say, we aren't going to allow this tool to be a part of political manipulation and gamesmanship. We are going to stand up and we're going to govern as part of statesmanship.
Well, but in the broader landscape, there's no question that the Republicans would rather cheat than compete. They've made that clear, and they're quite brazen and quite shameless about it, because I mentioned gerrymandering, they'll already pick up the House before one vote is cast. On voting day, they have all kinds of measures around the important states to restrict the voting of Democrats and particularly of minorities. Then after that, they get another bite of the apple because of these partisan legislatures. Republican legislatures have now allowed themselves to control the count and the certification of the vote. That is what Biden actually was talking about yesterday in Philadelphia, that this is a whole new form of subversion. He used the word subversion. And then, of course, the other aspect of this multi-pronged Republican assault on voting rights is that poll workers, independent poll workers, are being harassed. A recent poll had 50% of them feeling threatened, and a lot of them are quitting in droves, and they're getting replaced by the kind of crazy partisans that are doing the recount in Arizona. So that's the landscape out there, at least the way I see it. How do you see it, Keisha?
I think that's a fair assessment of what you've identified. And I think that goes to the point that the filibuster is not necessarily an appropriate tool in this context, that we need to look at where are the places that where citizens need to be protected, where we're seeing abuse of legislative power that is working to undermine ballot access, that's working to undermine the right to vote, to undermine constitutional rights. And so a carve out that stands to protect these rights is something that could be done and really has the opportunity to create the opportunity that really creates the opportunity for the Senate to act, to allow Biden to sign this bill, and to provide a baseline of protections nationally across the country, so we don't fall into a place where there's literally, you know, two Americas, depending on what party controls, that defines very differently who and how they can vote.
Well, I guess we'll see the extent to which both Manchin and Sinema want Biden and the Democrats to succeed. It would seem on the surface that they would, like all Democrats, would want this president to succeed and this party to succeed at this moment. So I thank you for joining us, Keisha Gaskins-Nathan.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Keisha Gaskins-Nathan, who's a lawyer, voting rights advocate, and director of the Democratic Practice Program at the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. She has spent much of her career advocating for the rights of underserved populations, especially with regard to voting rights and democratic reform. And from 2007 until 2011, she was executive director of the League of Women Voters of Minnesota, which succeeded in registering over 10,000 new voters during her tenure. We're going to take a brief station break and back with a look into the $3.5 trillion infrastructure package the Democrats plan to pass via budget reconciliation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and of the United States Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, thanks for joining us. And this $3.5 trillion package that Bernie Sanders has managed to get an agreement across the range of Democratic senators, including Senator Warner on the conservative side. And, of course, this is a package that they want to put through budget reconciliation on the 50 votes that they have, along with the vice president. But there are also rumors now, stirrings, I suppose you could say, Rob, that the other infrastructure deal that was a bipartisan deal that was done with a number of Republicans, my understanding is that a lot of these Republicans are now under pressure to pull out of the deal. So what's your understanding of what's happening with the bipartisan package before we talk about the $3.5 trillion package that is going to be put through reconciliation?
I think there's increasing tension as we approach the midterm election, and the Republican side does appear to be having, which Michael's second thoughts about participating or in essence, making the Democratic administration's leadership look good. On the other side of it, this is a very anxious and fragile time coming out of the pandemic and with concerns related to climate, debt relief, all kinds of elements. And so I wouldn't be surprised to see the Republicans harden for a bit to see what they can extract for constituents that are their supporters. But this is kind of a tug of war that leads to fundraising. And if you're able to deliver for your team, then you get support in your own reelection campaign.
Well, there's a dark money group called the Coalition to Protect American Workers that's run by Mike Pence's former chief of staff, Mark Short. And they're buying ads in Kansas to go after Jerry Moran, who's not a particularly famous senator, but he was a part of the group of Republicans that signed on to the bipartisan bill. So I guess this is sounds like a campaign that's just beginning, and it could get pretty ugly.
Well, you've seen Donald Trump talking about wanting to punish Lisa Murkowski in Alaska for which you might call straying from the team. And so I think that is, how would I say, that's not an uncommon practice. So I think this jockeying is, how would I say, closer to being started than to being finished. And then the question is, what can the Democrats do with their larger bill in the face of opposition, but given the rules that bypass a lot of the filibuster and other kinds of obstacles that but that the Republicans can put in place.
So if the bipartisan infrastructure bill collapses, is there any way to add that to the $3.5 trillion that's been negotiated within the Democratic Senate caucus?
That I'd have to research a little bit. I don't know if something which you might call has a precedent in one context in one committee can be transferred to another, meaning the budget committee, solely to avoid the, we shall may call the rules like filibuster. But I'm sure there will be temptations to bring over portions of that bill at very least.
Well, there was criticism of that bill, of course, from a lot of people who felt that the climate change issue is not addressed. And of course, you know, the money that went that came for what's needed in terms of electrifying the grid more with alternatives in order to make enough electricity for electrifying transportation, which is a huge undertaking. All of those ambitions were watered down considerably in that bipartisan bill. Could they reemerge in or be added to? In fact, maybe they are. I don't know the details of the $3.5 trillion bill, do you? It's just, we haven't really seen a lot of the sausage making here, have we?
No. We kind of know what you might call the advertising on the wrapper a little bit, but not the ingredients. But I'd say there is a very interesting dimension here, which is the coal and other fossil fuel oil businesses and so forth may be, digging in to retard the speed at which transformation of the transportation systems, the transformation being to electric things that are clean carbon and or carbon free or carbon diminished substantially. And I think there's a sense of urgency all around the world right now about both water and climate. But people who play defense, they play defense with information, like Michael Mann writes about in his book, The New Climate War. But they also play defense in the realm of lobbying and fundraising. And it may be that a Democrat-only bill could go further towards climate change. But that's also going to depend upon things like which senators are up for re-election and which ones are in fossil fuel-producing states, and also as it pertains to coalitions in the House.
Well, but surely the reason the Republicans resisted the more ambitious bill and settled for this bipartisan bill was because it stripped out taxing the rich and big corporations. And that's their bottom line, right? And in fact, they took a lot of money that's already in the pipeline from earlier stimulus bills and added that to their package. So how do you get this $3.5 trillion done without taxation if that's something that can't be dealt with through reconciliation because it's subject to the filibuster? Is that the situation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if a budget is approved, the question is it financed with taxation or bond issuance? And there are people who believe that in the realm of what's called modern monetary theory, that you could essentially bond finance and monetize a very substantial budget without a great deal of upward pressure on interest rates, others being more concerned about inflation. But it's not unlike the experience of war preparation. If you go back and read about FDR in Elliot Janeway's book, The Struggle for Survival, or Seth Klein, Naomi Klein's older brother, who wrote a book called The Good War about Canadian preparation for World War II and the analog that must be invoked now for the transformation of the Canadian economy, where they're both a substantial fossil fuel producer and consumer.
Well, the package does, of course, the $3.5 trillion does have climate initiatives in it. It also has enormous improvement to health insurance to get around those Republican governors who've stopped Medicaid expansion. And, of course, it's focused on human infrastructure like childcare, social welfare, housing. It also has something that the Affordable Care Act didn't deal with, and that is dental and vision. And dental, of course, has always been neglected, and so much health issues are a result from dental problems. So it's long overdue, isn't it? And I mean, this is something we all should be cheering, surely, if we knew more about it, I guess. Is that the situation, Rob?
Well, if I knew the details, I could say that they're, which are, Michael, going at the bullseyes that you described. And I don't quite know the details yet, but yes, there are a lot of things that have been neglected in the era of big tax cuts, large-scale military-industrial complex, the development of the pharmaceutical industry. I've even seen many conservative Democrats who are worried about debt acceleration talking about those sectors that have, how do you say, been the beneficiary of public policy in years past, need to now tighten their belts because there are other things. And given the amount of what you might call rage and despair and discomfort that people have experienced, I'll use January 6th as a signal, or even Donald Trump's time in office as a signal of those concerns, I think there are people that want to, which you might call, adjust the composition of what we do as spending priorities. And obviously the pandemic brings health right to the front of the list. And dental work as well.
Yeah, and hearing as well, as I might add. And again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He was the Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and of the United States Senate Budget Committee. So there is, I mean, first of all, the bill is likely to include money for civilian climate core IRS, and by the IRS and the better enforcement to fill up the tax gap. That's got a lot of Republicans freaked, apparently, which is, just shows you where their allegiances are to tax cheats. Mm-hmm. And then every major program that President Biden has asked for, I'm quoting Senator Schumer, has asked us for is funded in a robust way. So, again, no details, but what do you think Schumer means, funded in a robust way?
Well, I think there are lots of concerns about, where would the incidence of tax be? I'll quote the famous economist Joe Stiglitz, sometimes you can't tax goods, you got to tax bads. So perhaps a carbon tax with a carbon dividend to offset the things that exacerbate inequality would be one case in point. But Donald Trump, vis-a-vis China, was trying to introduce tariffs. That was a source of revenue. I don't know that that's necessarily leading to greater well-being, especially when the other country reciprocates. But the sense, you get, I've listened to Schumer recently a little bit, is that perhaps a higher capital gains rate, or which might say approximate repeal of the Trump tax cuts for the next phase, are considered feasible. Nobody was choking and agonizing before Trump did the tax cuts for the top. And maybe going back to that place, at least in the eyes of some moderate and progressive Democrats, is what they're alluding to.
Well, of course, Senator Bernie Sanders, the chair of the Budget Committee, he originally was pushing for a $6 trillion infrastructure package, again, largely human infrastructure as opposed to roads and bridges and deferred maintenance, because much of what is in the bipartisan bill is stuff that should have been done. And the stuff that should be done for the future, for a world ravaged by climate change, if we don't do anything about it, that actually got deferred. Now, Biden then proposed $4.5 trillion, and now they're settling for $3.5 trillion less. But as we started out talking in the beginning, Rob, we don't know whether the bipartisan bill deal is going to collapse. So when do you think there'll be some clarity on both what's in the $3.5 trillion and how it's going to be paid for, and what would happen, or how likely it is that the bipartisan bill is going to collapse, and then where do you go from there? So nothing is particularly clear.
We're in the middle of July, August. It's usually around back to school time that these things start to accelerate, because people are approaching the testing times and the actions and completion of a budget. But I would say you will probably in the coming couple of weeks see more of what people envision to be inside the 3.5. The curiosity is very high. The question of the tussle vis-a-vis the bipartisan bill, I think, will take a little longer to play out.
Well, I guess what's encouraging, though, is both Bernie and Mark Warner, from the left to the right and within the Democratic caucus, agree on this $3.5 trillion. So,
And with a midterm election coming up, having demonstrated that they were taking care of a broader range of the population in a time of great inequality and great suffering, does portend well for the Democratic Party in the midterm elections. They look like, if you will, they didn't make false promises. They delivered on their promise if they can pass a bill such as this of both scale and composition.
Well, but that's exactly why the Republicans resisted, isn't it? I mean, the child tax credit checks are going to be arriving, I believe, any day now. That's going to help the Democrats. Mm-hmm. And this $3.5 trillion has a lot more stuff in it, hearing, dental, vision, Medicare, Medicaid expansion, you name it. It's a lot of people are going to be helped by it. That's what's so weird about our politics. We have the politics of sabotage. Mitch McConnell has said, 100% of my focus is to stop the Biden administration. And he said the same about Obama. So I don't understand why the average American doesn't figure this out and say, my God, one party wants to help us and the other party just wants to make sure that the Democrats don't succeed in getting anything done. So it should be clear. but I guess it's not. What do you think's driving the Republicans?
Well, you have a structure in American politics, which, to use a kind of football simile, it's easier to block than it is to pass. And stopping things by vested interest has always been possible in an era of money politics. Originally, they envisioned the division of powers between the executive, judicial, and legislative branches as a balancing factor to filter out craziness or extremes. But I think in this era, where what you might call high-intensity social media demonizing and massive money politics and lobbying, a lot more, sense that the system is rigged and it is very hard for politicians to survive unless they play in that game. So I think we're in a place where some of the despondency about the political process being overcome with the passage of a healthy bill that fosters broad-based prosperity would very much strengthen the party, in this case, the Democratic Party, that advocated for it and proved they could realize it.
Well, Rob Johnson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks. It's always nice to talk with you, and we'll have to keep an eye peeled to see if we can dig up some details and come back to the microphone with a little more, micro perspective of the composition of the bill for your listeners.
Right. And heavens forbid that you should make life better for the American people, right? What a world. I thank you again. And Rob Johnson, of course, is Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and he was the Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and of the United States Senate Budget Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half past nine. Who will ever know how much she loved?
Time, one night in America. Time, one night.